talking about everybody getting crunk, crunk. Boys try to touch my junk, junk. Gonna smack him if he getting too drunk, drunk. Nah, nah, we go until they kick us out, out. The police shut us down, down. Police shut us down, down. Ho, ho, shut us down, down.
Chapter 3. Between Winry and Landy and the Blackwell Band, Ed dances a solid hour. Because once people see he can lift Win over his head, a bunch of other girls want to turn. He finally taps out once his thigh really starts to throb and he can feel sweat actively sliding into the port juncture. Staggering off back to the bathroom to gulp down water from the tap and get his hair in some kind of order. He's definitely done for the night, and gets going to convince Wynne that she is also. But there's a girl sitting at the top of the stairs blocking his way. She twists around to look at him, making Ed stop. A lot of people come to the horse parties, but one of the kids that lurk in the back of his poetry classes, trying to give him a run for the money in the boots and belts department, is not someone he expected to see here. And definitely not in a pastel sundress. Aline, he says, you're here and wearing colors? Aline sighs from what sounds like somewhere pretty deep inside her soul. She's missing all her piercings, too. Just a pair of pearl studs left in her earlobes. My last name's Tovil, Ed. Ed considers this, cross-references his memory, finds nothing, considers the possibility of error due to alcohol, and concludes whatever it is, he's not getting any positive matches regardless. Yes? And my hair's not naturally black. Okay. Aline sighs from somewhere even deeper. All right, look at my face. Now imagine I'm blonde and in a ponytail and yell, point your toes, Elric, a lot. What? Ed blurts, pointing stupidly at her as he suddenly sees it. You, McKenna has a sister? Aline rolls her eyes. A twin. She never mentions it. Neither do I, Aline says dryly. For obvious reasons.
What obvious reasons?
But she's your sister? Aline looks like she's considering a third sigh, but stands up instead, fixing the hem of her dress in a resigned sort of way. Not everybody's like you and Alphonse. Are you hiding from her up here? Not really, Ed says, deciding that if Aline wants to be weird and cryptic about her sister, that's her problem. Haven't seen her all night. I'm trying to get my friend and go, though. Then, because she looks like she's gonna sit right back down on the stairs like she's missed the last bus out of shithole wherever, he adds, wanna leave with us? Gods, yes, Aline says immediately. Tell McKenna I left with a boy. What, me? Sure, you. Why not? Fine, but only if you tell her we didn't sleep together, Ed stipulates as he starts down the stairs. McKenna yells at me when I fuck people she knows. She only cares because it makes you and another person late to practice, Aline grumbles, which is unfair, given Ed only ever made Camille late, and only the once, and that was only because they'd accidentally gotten one of her dreads stuck in Ed's zipper, which could have happened to anyone.
Though, actually, Aline says in a thoughtful and suddenly too innocent tone, can we say it was your brother instead?
Ed's about to say, wow, didn't know you wanted Jing to invade, but is saved by simultaneously spotting Winry and recalling just in time that, as far as the average acquaintance is concerned, May is just a language student that Al met in the East. Hey, Win! He yells instead, figuring Aline can create and solve her own problems. You want to blow this donkey farm?
It takes a few more songs and some whining about his potential rash, but Wynn does. Landy decides to come with them, which is probably the best intersection of Ed's two primary social groups, given Aline isn't one of the poetry people who can't make eye contact, and Landy is probably the nicest of the gymnasts besides Brinley, who would require a much stronger connection to reality to understand most insults, let alone craft his own. Probably fine with Winry, too, given her whole approach to poems and fiction in general, is about what you'd expect from someone whose idea of high art consists exclusively of things with cogwheels in them. Wait, Ed says as they gather to head out, remembering that one of Al's nerdlets was busy getting busy with presumably one of Ponytail's finest, after Al already left. I gotta go find a guy. Oh, Brinley, Landy says, like she's just remembered she'd left her stove on. Should we bring him too? Probably. Ed's pretty good at finding guys, and more importantly, has a finely tuned sense of where people hook up. So he finds Mr. Nerdlet Sex Haver within 5 minutes, his bow tie gone and locked into some deeply glazed conversation with his biker. Ed convinces the kid to leave with them while Wynn writes her number on Brett or Brant or Trant or whoever's arm, which really only works after Ed takes the marker from her, hands it to the biker, and puts Nerdlet's hand front and center, all while trying not to look like he's surreptitiously keeping an eye out for Ponytail. Ed's already been around the, well, maybe the sex will be better next time, track with people he meets off the street, and he knows himself enough to recognize he's not exactly going to be generous if they somehow get around too. Brinley's not hard to find, despite the fact that Ed hasn't seen him even once tonight. They collect him by one of the really big beer kegs, predictably drunk as shit and cow-blinking for a solid 5 seconds in Landy's face when she asks him if he wants to go home. That's pretty much a yes, whether he agrees or not. So Ed grabs his elbow and tows him in the right direction until they're off the grounds and he can more or less stagger along with the group due to a lack of alternative options. The trolleys have stopped running, so by general consensus, they head off towards the river. Following the canals is the easiest way to navigate when you don't have a car. There aren't that many pedestrian access bridges, but you can climb down into the overgrown maintenance tracks and hop across where there's water locks. There's a fence, but it's old and saggy, and they barely have to hop to climb over, letting them onto the damp canal side path. They've hardly been walking 10 minutes. Ed, forced into the position of loudly defending diagnosis critical due to Winry and Aline both thinking it's a shit show, not just a shit show, when the beam of a flashlight sweeps over them from around the bend just ahead. Halt! A male voice calls. Police! Oh, great. Cops. They halt, though it's a bit of a process given Brinley was bringing up the rear and new concepts like stop and go need to be introduced into his mental landscape with adequate care and lead time, even without the presence of alcohol. Ed steadies him and Wynn both and tries not to squint into the oncoming flashlights. Looks like only two officers. A second later, a hand fumbles at the back of his belt, and then Winry detaches his knife and chucks it, sheath and all, into the bushes without even looking. Wynn! You're not a state anything anymore. You don't even carry ID. Do you want to give them a reason? Winry hisses right in his ear. They're cops. You need to spend less time with Peninia, Ed swears. But at that point, the cops are pretty much walking up to them. And I do too carry ID. Evening, citizens, says the first cop as they slow to a stop in front of them, hitching his hands in his belt. What have we got here? It's not exactly original dialogue, but it's not, hey you, freeze, so Ed is willing to be magnanimous. Evening, he says, trying to channel Al's usual talking to strangers voice. Just on our way home. This is state property, the cop says, fairly mild. That makes this, he gestures between them, trespassing.
Sorry, we went off the path, we didn't realize,
Wynn says, quick and sweet, with a calculated bit of fluster, stepping closer to put herself on Ed's shoulder in the nice girlfriend few brain cells. Oh no, we're both silly variant.
We can get right back on the road, sorry.
Trespassing's trespassing. It's a crime, the cop says, clearly appreciating how Wynn's tits are now halfway sandwiching Ed's bicep, even if it's not motivating him to be anything but more condescending. Ignorance of the law is no defense. And we can't just ignore crimes, the other cop says, putting his hands on his hips in a very schoolmarm fashion. This town would be a real bad place if we just went around ignoring crimes. So what are we going to do with you?
Wow, trespassing. Two steps away from goddamn violent felony.
Sometimes, Ed thinks, not without irony, he really misses being a state alchemist. Some cops would turn up, he'd flash his watch, they'd back off, no questions asked. Anybody with him was automatically considered luggage. He was a problem everyone hoped was there to happen to someone else. Not anymore, though. As it is, he has to dig out his wallet with his non-sandwiched arm and cough up some cash. Here, he says, holding the bills out to the cop, knowing he sounds deeply sarcastic but not caring enough to do anything about it. Let's all have a nice night, yeah? The cop looks at the 350s, takes them, then looks their group over again. Attempting to bribe an officer. That's a serious offense.
And he pockets the money. Oh, this asshole.
Is that not the going rate? Ed says, trying not to talk through his teeth as Winry not so subtly digs her fingers into his back. Vodka price has gone up recently? Gosh, wow. You a daytime comedian, sweetheart? The cop grins mirthlessly, gesturing to his partner. Line up, all of you. Hands on your head. Ed tries not to sneer as he puts his hands up, mostly because Wynn's glaring a combination of behave and I told you so, as she lines up, even politely setting her legs apart. The cop starts the pat-down with her, though that's probably less because of her indicating cooperation and more because her proto-shirt wasn't at 100% opacity even before she sweated it through dancing. This is so fucking stupid. It's not even a real cop stop. They're just going to inconvenience them and let them go, though clearly not without extracting more sense from all of them than they want to part with. The pat-down cop takes his sweet time, moving on from a quietly exasperated Winry to a quivering nerdlet and a parade rest straight-backed Aline as the other cop idly rifles through the wallets he'd pulled, not even pretending to check their ID. When the pat-down cop finishes Landy and straightens up to loom, Brinley flinches a bit, drunk enough that it comes on a delay and makes it even more noticeable. The cop grins like this is the best compliment ever and moves on to Ed. Ed stares dead ahead and focuses on counting the streetlights just visible up over the embankment so as not to give in to the temptation to flip the fuck into the bushes, send his partner after him and take off. The pat-down is a joke. Ed can tell right away that the cop hasn't even noticed he's got automail, barely brushing a hand down his calf. He'd call this whole thing an excuse to grope them, only this guy is clearly more invested in intimidation than feeling them up. Or at least feeling Ed up. When the cop's done, he circles around them, and when he passes Brinley, who does his hair super carefully and wears a lot of really tailored pants, and drunkenly confided to Ed once that he wants his first time to be with someone special. There's a dull slap And Brinley jerks hard, almost jumping forward as his eyes go wide. Later, Ed thinks that if he'd been all the way sober, he would have at least punched in the other direction. As it is, his fist slams the cop in the cheekbone, right under the temple, and topples him into the water. He used his right hand on reflex, which means he's hissing and shaking his knuckles out as the splash sends them all scattering out of line. Landy squeals, Brinley lurches back with his mouth open, and Winry and the other cop all start shouting something. But Ed's got his eyes on the foaming canal and how it's not splashing around enough. There's a non-zero chance he just knocked this cop out, which means if he doesn't get pulled out before he inhales water, he's gonna drown. "Oh, fuck me," Ed says, and jumps in after. The canal isn't that deep, but it's night and it's murky and the visibility is fucking zero. At least there's not much of a current, which is a small fucking blessing given he's basically guaranteed to contract some kind of horrible bilge disease heretofore only found present in mutant rat populations. He seals his mouth tight and lets his legs sink him like a stone, touching his boots to the bottom. And a second later, his seeking hand hits something flailing around in the water. It's either the cop or a really big sewer eel in full uniform. So Ed grabs, goddamn grab-ass here, around an armpit and shoves up, kicking hard off the bottom. Thank fuck he got all that practice swimming with his automail in Huangcheng Chao, because otherwise, he'd be struggling even without 200 pounds of asshole trying to concuss him with a lot of vigor that could really be put towards independent swimming. They breach the surface like a couple of angry beach balls, Ed heaving grab ass off him once it's clear the asshole's very much awake and mobile. There's a lot of shouting going on, but Ed's busy spitting as thoroughly as he can while searching for the quickest handholds up out of here. It's not that hard to climb out via the nearest maintenance rungs, which unfortunately means that when he pulls himself up, grab-ass is right behind him. This must be what being chased by a hungry walrus is like, Ed thinks as he rolls out of the way of grab-ass's lurching swipe. Not that it really gets him anywhere. The dry cop's trying to get past where Winry's grabbed Landy, like she's keeping her from jumping in too, and the nerdlet is staring at them all with his mouth hanging open and his eyes bugging. Grabass's incoherent bellowing is starting to have a lot of words like assault and you little shit in it. So Ed snarls back, "I just saved your fucking life, asshole!" Grabass sputters, partially in outrage, but mostly because what Ed is self-defensively calling water is still streaming down his face. "You're the one who threw me in there!" "No, you fucking fell!" Ed scrambles up off all fours, swiping wet hair out of his face. "And this wouldn't have happened if you weren't slapping ass, you fucking asshole!" Saying it reminds Ed all over again that this guy could use a few more lessons in corrective behavior, actually. And he's drawing his leg back to boot this fucker onto his back when Winry shouts, "Ed!" It warns Ed enough to dodge out of the way of the other cop's nightstick, sending him lurching past and almost into grab-ass. But the tone wasn't "watch out" so much as "what the fuck are you doing?" Which, she's right. Ed is fully and legally a damn civilian, which means it's going to be a bad fucking idea to catch the stick and thrash these two. Because he's already landed himself on the bullshit carousel just by decking this thick-skulled pervert. This is not a situation that's going to be solved by a couple of uppercuts. Then the nightstick comes down again. Reflex takes over. There's a fast couple of seconds, followed by Ed and the cop several feet apart, giving the nightstick identical looks of horror. This is due to it now being in Ed's hand, where it is 100% not supposed to be, not de-escalating anything whatsoever. "Shit," Ed and Winry say simultaneously, with pretty much equal levels of feeling. Behind the cop, Grabass is staggering to his feet, clutching his head and groping for his cuffs. Ed decides disarming is his best bet and throws the nightstick over his shoulder into, fuck, shit, the canal. Nobody move, you're all under arrest. Grabass yells. Nightstick cop snarls and charges. So they get arrested. Ed gets a little bit tackled, which probably would have gone worse for both of them if he hadn't automatically flipped Nightstick's charge to avoid getting a double dip in the water. This obviously doesn't fucking win him any favors despite keeping Nightstick dry, but they pretty clearly aren't dealing with the goddamn intelligentsia tonight. Ed helpfully points this out and gets a lot of invective in return, followed by a pretty high-speed injunction into the backseat of their car, shortly joined by the others, sardining all of them haphazardly in the back seat, meant for three not particularly large people. And every one of them is staring at him, despite the fact that they're basically all sitting on top of each other to fit. Except Wynn, who's just glaring. Ed scowls on principle. What the fuck was that? Wynn glares. Well, what the fuck was I supposed to do? Ed scowls back. Not fucking that, Wynn glares. Oh, now that's helpful, Ed scowls. How did you do that? It's Nerdlet. Do what? Ed snaps. You just, with your knee, and then you just spun him, and when he... Shut up back there, Nightstick snarls, smacking the back of his hand against the wire mesh separating the front and back seats, and starts the car. Ed thunks his head back against the seat and takes satisfaction in the fact that he's soaking the shit out of the upholstery. Though even that's mitigated by how he's also getting Landy wet beside him and she's starting to shiver. Ugh. Ed doesn't have time to sit around in jail. He's got to go home and disinfect his leg port, for one thing, which he has learned has to be a nightly occurrence unless he wants that gross rash to come back. Especially now that the naggingly unsatisfying soreness between his thighs has been entirely replaced with a squelchingly comprehensive yuck. He fucking hopes that whatever inevitably disgusting mutant cholera he's going to get from his stupid canal dip makes the damn cop's dick drop off. And Wynn's only here for a week, which fuck knows how long they'll be sitting in lockup if the cops deny them bail. Which they will, because Ed was just so sparklingly quick on the uptake that he fucking disarmed one and clocked another into the river. Ugh. If Brinley wasn't so drunk and Ed's leg wasn't so sore, he would have made them all just run. Should have shoved them both in the river and taken off. Cops hate chasing people. This is what happens when he drinks. He gets fucking stupid. Nightstick and Grabass pull into the station compound and then leave them alone in the car, which isn't much of an incentive to try anything, given the parking lot is full of officers on break or off duty, standing around smoking and talking. If Ed were alone, or with just Wynn, he'd take his chances. But sardined in like this, he'd need alchemy just to uncuff himself, let alone unlock the car. And it's not like that'd be hard. His hands are practically squished together right now. But so far, he's managed to keep anyone at school from finding out he's an alchemist. And he's gonna hold that streak as long as he can. Fuck, this is annoying. He's not fucking sorry he punched Grabass, but he can tell that this isn't, like, an improvement on what it would have been if he'd just let it slide. He's resigned to sitting there in sullen silence until he realizes Landy's not shaking because she's cold. She's crying. Wynn's on the very other side of the seat, sandwiched into Brinley's lap. Ed tries to crane around Landy to make SOS eye contact, but Wynn's glaring out the window. Not that getting her attention will do more than make Wynn start yelling at him, but people generally stop doing what they're doing to watch Wynn yell at him, and he doesn't see why crying would be any different. Wynn also hasn't noticed the crying on her own, because Landy's actually pretty quiet. And if Wynn had noticed, she'd be doing something about it, because she's a better person than Ed is. Ed does not have a great track record with getting people to stop crying, but he needs to at least tap Winry in without going, "Yo, tears on your 3 o'clock. Landy's tough. Ed knows for a fact. She's like Al, cries about kittens, but won't bat an eye at broken bones and split skin. But he's only known her half a year, if that. And that's not enough, he's realizing, to really know. Darius, Henkel, Greed, he'd known all of them less than a month before knowing exactly which way they'd go in a fight, what would get him cuffed over the head, and what get them genuinely angry. Hell, how they took their tea when they could get tea. But those had been pretty different circumstances. "Hey," he tries, are the cuffs pinching?" Landy at least tries to get herself under control at that, sucking in a couple of deep breaths. "My mom's gonna kill me," she whispers, voice creaking. "Mine too," Aline speaks up. She's not crying, but she sounds way bleaker about it than Ed feels is warranted. That seems to be it, which, okay, the flash of annoyance doesn't last long because Ed can recognize it's stupid and pointless besides. To be, what, jealous of them? It's good they've got moms to worry. Not least because it likely means they'll be able to get out of this without any actual damage happening. Nobody goes to Central U poor, even if a lot of them think they are. So they'll be able to afford the bribes, which means the cops will most likely just let them go after instead of charging them as accomplices to Ed's assault on an officer or whatever. Wynn sighs. "Ask for a phone call anyway." She knows she and Ed are going to have to do some really annoying negotiating just to get the chance to bribe themselves out instead of getting parked in a fucking holding until sentencing. At least she knows Ed's good to pay up for his dumbassery. "They'll probably give it to you, especially if you cry a bit and talk about how your parents will really, really want to avoid fuss and get you out. That's generally going to get a better deal for them than letting you wait for trial, so the judge will take a cut," she adds, reminding Ed that she's been arrested like 4 times before, along with everyone else existing while a teenager in Rush Valley. This is Central, though, and Ed's only been arrested by military police before, and as an alchemist besides, so his processing was always different from the start. To begin with, nobody's pointing a gun at him, and the officers left them without a guard in this car. Presumably, this intake's gonna be the same, given he's proven himself, violent. And he's gonna have to figure out who and how to ask for a phone call to Al. Only Al's not even home. Shit. Ed has no idea whether that friend he's staying with tonight even has a phone, let alone the number. Teacher's in Dublith and won't have access to the necessary money unless Al writes her into the approved list on Ed's accounts. But either way, that's going to take a while, and the cops are probably going to bung him into prison to await sentencing first thing tomorrow morning, just on sheer pissiness. Who does he even know in Central who'll bail him out before dawn? Well, Mustang. But well, Mustang. Mustang wouldn't have gotten into this shit. If caught drunk and wandering some maintenance track, he would have slicked out a smile and whipped out some words that wouldn't even register as a bribe or threat. Just go directly to the brainstem and whisper what a good idea it'd be to play nice. He would have had the cops tipping their hats to him after they dropped him off at his house. "What a nice gentleman. No thank you, sir. Have a good night." He would not be impressed by this, especially since Ed should not just know better, but fully be capable of making sure that he, as a guy with some seriously sketchy shit going on in his background, stays away from any inconvenient run-ins with the system. Come to think of it, Ed is not actually sure whether he's dead or not. That might be a problem. The cops are going to run his ID to see if he's got any priors, and he doesn't actually know whether his military record is going to show up if they submit his identification number. Not that they'd get his actual record, but they very well might get back that he has one and that it's sealed, which wouldn't really impact the cops much. But when someone tries to access a sealed military record, Ed knows, lots of little red flags go up, especially in intelligence. And Hughes doesn't actually have everyone in that department sitting pretty in his noose-like pockets. And since Ed hadn't actually died in any provable way, he just fucked off after the eclipse with Al, and the military hadn't released any kind of official statement on him due to a combination of standard policy regarding state alchemists and Mustang starting to grab people by the balls, there are a lot of people with questions about what did, in fact, happen to the Fullmetal Alchemist. Some of those people are now pretty high up in the military, and they are not what Ed would call his friends. Given that Ed would have gotten arrested at some point sooner or later, he probably should have given Mustang a call before now about what's up with his ID. Or, at the very least, familiarize himself with who exactly would be getting notified if civilian police ran his papers. Hughes, sure, but it's not like Hughes is personally handling various police requests for government checks. And probably not any of his handpicked people either. The cops liaise directly with the Justice Ministry first in any case, don't they? Because they're the ones who handle federal crimes, and the priors check also determines whether he's wanted in another province or whatever. So either way, intelligence wouldn't get notified first, not until someone in Justice flagged it. And Ed's not going to assume Mustang has the entire Justice Ministry on its knees asking for seconds, no matter what some squeak-voiced poli-sci undergrad's dad thinks. Well, shit. Maybe Ed can bribe the cops in intake? Not that he has enough cash in the emergency stash in his boot to actually spring him once they've been brought all the way back to the station. And his wallet is already doubtlessly currently swamp-melding into a single fused wet lump in some evidence officer's grubby thieving paw. Ed probably won't even be able to promise his way into a private phone call. It'll have to be private, because for this, he does have to call Mustang. Going dark hasn't actually required much effort on Ed and Al's part, largely because Al is no longer a 7-foot-tall suit of armor, and everyone knows the Fullmetal Alchemist had an automail arm. Fucking off to ass nowhere immediately after the promise day, and then mostly traveling since probably helped too. There aren't a lot of photos of Ed in press, and the ones that did once occupy the front page are generally blurry, half turned away or cutting off the entire bottom half of his face, entirely due to the image being centered on Al. Not a lot of people know the Fullmetal Alchemist was named Elric, let alone Ed. But either way, in his modern lit class alone, there's 3 Edwards, an Edgar, and an Edric, on top of like 17 Elrics across campus, let alone all of Amstress. The most intensive thing they've had to do so far is bribe Granny with Cretian tobacco to write up Ed a fake set of immunization papers, since his actual vaccine records are in some military medical office in East HQ. But none of that's going to matter when it comes to his identification number and military record. And since Mustang hasn't so much as raised the question of Ed returning to public visibility, he also doesn't want to deal with people knowing Fullmetal's not just not dead, but right here in Central. Especially the brass. Okay, Making a break for it isn't actually going to solve anything, because making this more of an incident is only going to bring down more attention. They have his ID card, even if it is soaked, which in Ed's case is going to be worse than being booked as undocumented. He should have tossed his wallet when Wynn tossed his knife. Making them verify his name and number would have at least bought him some time. Fuck, he's never drinking again. He can't fucking afford to be this goddamn slow. Nightstick and Grabass come back, open the doors, and start hauling them out. Not particularly gently. Ed scowls and keeps his mouth shut and lets himself get towed along, deliberately not looking at Grabass the wet wonder so as not to start shit again. This doesn't stop him from hearing the squelch of his boots, though, which is a tiny, petty thing of a consolation prize, given that Ed's boots are squelching, too. Luckily, an entire string of loud drunks are being processed by multiple pairs of officers right at the same time, so the intake desk doesn't make time for Nightstick or Grabass to dick them around beyond shoving and growling. Winry formally requests a phone call and is just as formally denied, after an extremely clear once-over by the intake officer, who isn't even trying to hide that she's pricing out Winry's whole outfit down to the shoes. This fully shafts them into bitch category. They're going to be shaken down until their fillings come out. The precinct will give it a solid 24 to 36 hours without allowing any outside contact to let their loved ones get nice and worried, thus making them that much more eager to pony up with bribe money and uninclined to negotiate. Anything, please, just let my sweet baby darling out of here. It's a pretty fair bet on the cops' part. They're all clearly college kids, which means parents who can afford it, and Ed's boots are new. Landy's got gold earrings in, and Brinley looks like he fell off a catwalk for a pretty specific kind of high society wear. No one else tries asking for a phone call, sticking to watching Ed out of the corners of their eyes, looking watery and bleak and shrinking away from the cops. They get fingerprinted and photographed along with the long line of rowdy drunks, and everyone else gets their hands recuffed in front of them when they get their booking bracelet. Unlike Ed, but it's not like he wasn't expecting it. It's not exactly comfortable for his right shoulder, but the only cuffs that are genuinely going to bother him are stocks, and he's not going to give them a reason to think of them. Hell, they haven't even taken off his shoes. The building is old, half built over, and the holding cells are, of course, in the basement. One of the drunks, probably a regular in here, starts singing loudly as they get led down, clearly delighted by the echoes. They get lucky in the split. Wynn and the rest get a cell to themselves, and since Nightstick's the one dragging Ed along by the arm, he gets stuck in alone. The drunks all piled into the cell diagonally across from his. The cops go back upstairs. The door slams, and they're left alone in the basement. Ed stares at Wynn and the others. They stare at him. Aline looks deeply wary. Landy's still crying. Brinley seems to be stuck in blank bafflement, and Nerdlet's expression is starting to veer dangerously close to the one he wore at the drinks table with his biker buddy. Ed makes eye contact with Wynn as much for self-preservation as for communication purposes. She shuffles over to the corner of the cell, pressing her face to the bars, and Ed does the same on his side. "I need a distraction," he mutters, as quiet as he can, to still get heard under the drunks. Wynn's face immediately goes forbidding. "For what?" "To make a phone call," Ed hisses. "Look, we can't just sit in here. I need to..." "Al's not going to be able to..." I know. Ed works his jaw for a second. "Not Al." Wynn's expression does not improve, because even if she doesn't immediately know who he's calling, the list of people is pretty much narrowed to central, and nobody here is without a price. "I know what I'm doing, okay? I'm getting us out of here," Ed whispers, which he will. He's the one who got them arrested. But this has to be taken care of first. He jerks a thumb over his shoulder at the cell opposite them. So I need to get to a phone, but they're gonna raise hell if they see me walk out.
You need a distraction,
Landy says damply. She stood up too, moving to stand beside Winry. Ed and Win both look at her, then at each other. I can spring us, I think, Ed says after a second. I just gotta make a phone call. Aline and Brinley and Nerdlit are watching all of them now, all of their expressions merged into baffled, cautious fascination. Landy's big, wet eyes go from Ed to Winry and back to Ed again. She sniffs.
You're gonna get us out?
Yeah, Ed says, because hell, what's a couple of grand out of his bank account? Not like he can't earn it back. I am.
Okay,
Landy says, wiping her eyes. Then she turns, walks to the other corner facing the drunks, and lifts up the front of her shirt. Nerdlit gasps. One of the drunks in the cell glances over, double takes and bugs his eyes, frantically pats the arm of the guy next to him.
Whoa, says Winry. If you guys don't make any noise, Landy says sternly, to her suddenly highly attentive audience, I'll take off my bra.
Rapt silence descends on the hallway. Win stares some more, then darts her eyes to Ed and jerks her chin sharply down the hall. He drops to the ground, face hot. He has to pike his legs up to fold himself in half and loop his cuffed arms from back to front. But then he's free to move, and nobody's watching except for Nerdlit, who's got his mouth open again and can't seem to decide which sideshow to ogle. Ed ignores him, jams himself into the very furthest corner between the bars and the wall. Landy's bra, he can't help but notice, is bright candy pink. And he hurriedly looks down to where he's jamming his left boot lengthwise into the space between the wall and the bars, heel to the stone. He's got two joints in his automail leg, flexed in opposite directions. That means what he has, properly applied, is a titanium crowbar, capped on either end with solid steel. He braces his kneecap into the bar, sets his heel into the wall, and pushes his whole body weight down. Ancient metal bends with a creaking groan, and there's a startled noise from the other cell, some heads turning his way. But then Landy bounces up and down pointedly.
Hey,
she says reprovingly, only slightly undermined by how she hiccups.
Eyes over here.
Yeah, Winry says in a sugared voice, stepping up behind Landy and tossing her hair. Don't you want to see what happens next? Ed, face burning, crouches with his back to the wall, eels through the gap and takes off down the hallway before he can find out what kind of meltdown can be caused by a logarithmically intensifying cocktail of rage, awe, and embarrassment. The window he saw in the stairwell should be just about big enough to fit him, and that he can transmute open, because it's a blind corner and there's no one to see. Splitting the chain on his cuffs while he's at it. Then he's outside, crouched on a tiny cement window ledge right by the building's dumpsters. If he leaves the compound, there'll be public phones, but those are pay phones, and he doesn't have any change. Ed grits his teeth, checks again for any witnesses, and scampers up the wall towards the cop offices. He's lucky. Middle of the night shift means all the lights up here are off, and all the agents on duty downstairs. No late nights for the boss. Ed grips on the window ledge, practically mushing his nose to the glass, and scans the room. It's hard to see in, dark inside as it is out. But Ed can just about make out the desk, chair, lamp, telephone. Jackpot. He jimmies the window. No alchemy necessary. It's not even locked. Why would it be? In a cop shop on the third floor. And wiggles inside. He's got Mustang's personal line. He's banking on the assumption that anybody calling Mustang does so only due to dire emergency, which hopefully means the bastard will pick up. Ed doesn't know the current office phone number, and he isn't about to put this call through the general switchboard. When the bastard does pick up, his voice is somehow even deeper than usual.
Mustang.
Yo, it's me, Ed says, suddenly extremely glad he's not doing this in front of, oh, anybody? He rides out the familiar tingly swoop and fights the urge to cross his legs, suddenly extremely grateful everything in his pants is currently a no-go contamination zone. I got a question. If Central Cops run my ID, what are they going to get back out of that?
Ed?
Mustang says, in rough bewilderment, that segues immediately into,
what did you do?
Nothing.
Nothing?
Trespassing. I was walking some of the kids home from a party. We took a shortcut, ran into some cops.
Trespassing.
Mustang repeats, disbelief dripping.
That's it.
Well, I might have done some other stuff too, Ed says, eyeballing the doorway and trying not to focus on how Mustang sounds like he's been gargling sandpaper with strep. There's a faint rustling over the line on his end, like fabric moving. Like maybe Mustang rolled over. Is he in bed? Okay, it makes sense for him to have a phone on his nightstand, but focus! Focus! It depends. Point is, they took my info and they're gonna run me, so figured you should know. Ed feels Mustang go from exasperated to bastarding on all cylinders in the span of a second.
It depends.
Ed closes his eyes and knocks his forehead a couple of times against the wall. I punched a cop. There's a short silence.
All right, Mustang says. Why?
He was being an asshole. And I'm stupid, defending a thesis in moron. Drunk. So when he started slapping ass, I decked him into the canal. So they got pretty mad about it. Look, they booked me, but I can get out probably and figure out bail for no. Mustang says flatly, a tone without any give, pulling Ed up short. Mustang doesn't actually get pissed at him often. Ed's seen real mad, and Mustang might bark, but he doesn't get there without some real fucking motivators. So Ed can tell himself it's all part of the tingle, that stealing Mustang's coffee and doodling in his work planner and replacing his dumb tulip doormat with, come back with a warrant, is all the adrenaline thrill of sticking his hand in the tiger's mouth. But the truth is, he knows Mustang won't bite him. Already bit him as hard as he could go, in fact, years ago, and isn't about to shift his grip. There's a safety there in knowing exactly how bad something can hurt you. And Mustang likes Ed, mainly because Mustang's a perverse sadist bastard that'd cheer for anyone that fucked with the military. But that doesn't change that he does like him. Ed may have been put on this earth to spill, break, crash, ruin, or otherwise void the warranty of anything unlucky enough to be in reach. But for Mustang, that's always been a plus. So when he's mad at Ed, real mad, because Ed did something dumb, it doesn't feel good.
Where are you? Mustang says.
He's still flat with displeasure, the kind of voice that lives on the other side of arguments.
Ed says, still taken aback. He wants to say, well, what?
It's not that bad. I can fix it. It is that bad, and he can't fix it. It's why he called in the first place. West Central Precinct, off Marble, in the drunk tank. Well, I broke out and then back in, calling from some cop office upstairs. Mustang gives a hard exhale that conveys several buckets worth of whiskey worth of how much he regrets ever trekking out to Resinbul that one faithful October day. Ed's starting to really hate everything about this day, including the fact that he only no longer has Ponytail's sweat on him by virtue of it being replaced with filthy canal water. Even discovering the late-night burr in Mustang's voice isn't enough to mitigate things. Not when this voice comes with it, the tone that says, "You aren't even worth an argument." Ed's always worth an argument. Or at least, he was. Back when he was a guy actually doing shit, not another drunk college hero discovering he's not above consequences.
"What are you wearing?"
The noise that comes out of Ed sounds like a seagull choking on a slide whistle.
"What?"
There's another sigh.
"How disreputable do you look right now, Elric?"
"What?" Ed has no fucking idea what's going on. What does that have to do with, I don't know, medium?
"Is Alphonse with you?"
"No." Mustang's gotta be going somewhere with this. Winry is, and some friends.
"What are their names?"
You know Winry. Ed lists everybody off, though when he gets to Aline, Mustang says sharply,
"Toville?"
Shit, is her family famous or something? "Yeah," Ed says cautiously. "Why?"
"Get back in your cell and don't give them a reason to transport you,"
Mustang answers, which, okay, fucking fine.
"I'll take care of the paperwork. Stay put and play along."
And with that, there's a click, phone hanging up. Ed glowers at the handset for a bit. Fucking bullshit, cryptic, double bullshit bouquet. Well, what did he expect? At least he's passed on the necessary information. This is probably the best outcome his dumbass bullshit stupid knight could get. Getting back to the cell isn't that much harder than getting out, because the noise in the cell block is up by an appreciable volume, despite the fact that whatever Landy and Winry were doing is very much over. Ed remembers just in time to transmute his cuffs back together right before turning the corner. Glad that any sounds are covered by the cell full of drunks having some kind of extremely involved argument that has all of them huddled up in a circle. One guy does see him and starts to say, "Hey, what?" But Ed lets his face show exactly how good of a day he isn't having. "Keep your mouth shut or I'll come shut it for you," he snaps, ramming his knee into the cell bar hard enough to dent it back into place, and the guy takes the hint. Winry and the others are all back on their bench, silently staring at him again, though at least with everyone's clothes fully back in place. Ed tries not to glare back at them as he grits his teeth, pikes on the floor again, and slides his cuffed hands behind his back, which is not fucking graceful no matter what you do. Brinley now looks vaguely green. Aline has a disturbed look, and Nerdlet once a fucking again is fishing for flies with his mouth open. But that's probably because they all keep glancing between the bent cell bar and Ed's leg like they've never seen automail before. At least Landy's busy rubbing her eyes with the back of her wrists. Wynne just raises her eyebrows at him, more "now what?" than expectant. Ed glances over at the other cell, where the drunks are conducting their argument, and very studiously not looking over at them. "Y'all okay in there?" "Fine," Wynne says, extremely dry. "They yelled some after we got tired of holding our shirts up, but I told them a couple of farm stories and they calmed right down."
"I didn't know they did that to horses," Brinley mumbles, now staring at the ground with the distinct look of someone who's just experienced a highly detailed Rockabell educational experience about testicles. "They just like that, and then they take, and the tweezers."
Wynne pats his thigh in a, "There, there, yes, of course I know how to remove your testicles, but I'm not going to do it right this moment," way. "And you?"
"Called,"
Ed grunts, sitting down on his own bench, knowing he probably looks more sour than confident. Now we wait. None of them look particularly reassured, even if Wynn just seems mostly exasperated. But it does pretty much end the conversation, which works fine for Ed. He tips his chin down, making the direction of his gaze not obvious, and sizes up Aline. If Mustang recognized her last name, there's probably leverage there she wouldn't want anyone to have, in a way that's a bit bigger than Mommy and Daddy pitching a fit. Accidentally or not, Ed just gave it to Mustang. However, if it's leverage Mustang wants, he should probably have it. Ed has no idea who Aline's parents are or what they do, but he does know Mustang. If he's just handed Mustang something he thinks he can use, it's going to be for the specific purpose of making Amstrad somewhat less of a shit show. And if Ed tells Aline now, even without mentioning Mustang, that'll most likely end up warning her parents. A warning Mustang probably won't want them to have. Ed keeps his mouth shut. He can't afford not to think about the bigger picture. Not thinking about the bigger picture is what got them in here. He can't just think about Aline and McKenna as some kids I know, just friends from school. He likes them well enough, but not so much that he'll start sticking his oar in after sicking Mustang on them, inadvertently or not. He did involve Mustang, and that supersedes the rest. Just another goddamn thing he should have thought about before thinking with his fist. Anyway, they're adults, so are their parents, and if they're operating at a level where Mustang is noticing them, that's a pretty solid indicator that they can damn well take care of themselves. Mustang's help is announced by the door up above opening, echoing the sound of high heels rapping on concrete down the stairwell. The drunks briefly quiet down. A moment later, a completely new cop with a sour look on his face leads a glossy-looking woman into the hall, walking past the drunk tank and gesturing flatly between their two cells. The woman gives Ed a cool look. Ed's unclear as to what exactly he needs to be playing along with, so he keeps his mouth shut and tries not to glare. "Yeah, that's them," the woman says, unimpressed. "Come on. We haven't got all night." The cop proceeds to unlock the cells, ushering them out with an equally impatient look on his face. They got uncuffed, even. Wynn glancing back at Ed with a big, "Should we be going along with this?" in her eyes as the woman leaves the hall without looking back, heading back up the stairs. Ed tries to communicate back that he has no fucking idea what's going on, but if it's getting them the fuck out of here, they should take it. This is probably Mustang's doing. To be fair, Ed expected some harried second lieutenant, not a hot redhead in a trench coat managing to look money as hell, despite straining hard up top to contain some serious figure. But then again, it makes sense that it isn't. It's the military Mustang doesn't want finding out about Ed, after all, and it's not like anyone else knows they're here. They file out onto the main floor of the station, cop bringing up the rear. There's another woman there, standing at the head of the bullpen, weight balanced on one hip and staring out at the room like it's beneath her to even think of stepping further. She's darker than Ed and blonder than Winry, eyes visibly green from across the room. And between the silk night scarf slipping artfully off her hair and the glossy cigarette holder she's smoking from, she looks rich, rolled out of bed and ready to make someone pay for it. And as they get closer, Ed realizes why Mustang asked him how trashy he looks. The makeup's a little too vivid, the heels a little too high for anything but 3 o'clock in the morning. They both got long coats on, even though it's not cold out. And that rolled-out-of-bed look on the blonde one is definitely the result of a couple hours of work by a paid professional. If Ed thinks about it for one fucking second, he is not at all surprised Mustang holds favors from professional escorts, nor that he'd use them for this. Thank fuck Winry didn't decide to wear a real shirt tonight. Pretending to be a bunch of what? Junior hookers? Escorts in training? Is not something Ed would have thought of as an escape hatch, but he'll take it.
Thank you, Nostra,
the smoking woman says to the redhead. And Ed gets double confirmation she's with Mustang. They both use the same kind of voice. The one that says they can make you strip naked right there if they want to. And what's more, you should go to sleep every night begging your God it'll happen. How well does Mustang know her? If Ed thinks about it for 2 seconds, it's actually pretty hard to picture Mustang paying for sex. Going to the party districts, absolutely. But given how much he dates around, Ed can't see why he'd bother to actually cash out. Unless he's into, like, specific stuff. Is he into stuff? What kind?
Took them long enough,
the redhead says boredly, going to the smoking woman's side. She narrows her eyes when she sees Ed staring, which, right, he's got more immediate concerns than what freak flavor Mustang's got hiding under the brick-thick overlay of roses, candlelight, and missionary vanilla. Though, it can't be too depraved. No, it absolutely has to be. That's the only thing that'll explain why Mustang has sex workers owing him and not the other way around. It'd be exactly like him to go digging before he does his dirties and line up some preemptive blackmail to get them on his string before he ends up on theirs.
Keep better track of your merchandise, one of the cops mutters, waving them to the glass-walled desk of intake and picking up the smaller ring of keys for the ID tagging bracelets.
The two women ignore him. Ed doesn't, because, okay, what do they think Ed and Wynn and everybody else are? Some kind of group party favor? How often does that happen? Did someone go down a menu and say, I'd like the co-ed party pack variety taste test package? A door opens in the back of the room and a stout, harried-looking guy in a creased shirt and suspenders sticks his head out, narrows his eyes, and zeroes in on the smoking woman.
You, he says, scowling.
Of course it is.
Detective Faisal, the woman says languidly,
more smoke drifting out on her breath, the air around her suffused bitter and floral.
Good morning.
Yeah, hi, you're all getting a ticket, the man says crossly, waving around at Ed and the others. Desk appearance, no argument. There's enough on my plate already without getting into it with the courts.
We understand your position completely, the woman demurs, somehow managing to project that she's apologizing while simultaneously making it understood that she wouldn't fucking lower herself. But we can't help accidents, detective. None of them even have priors.
Boy, Ed sure hopes she's right.
You make it to booking, you get written up. You get written up, you're my problem,
the detective says flatly, making a cutting gesture in front of him. Rules are rules. What am I supposed to tell the captain? The dog ate our paperwork? The smoking woman could now be said to look amused, if crocodiles could be said to smile.
How could I possibly argue?
It sounds like she's agreeing, and it only makes the detective's face tighten, his shoulders setting like he's bracing for something. There's not a single doubt left in Ed's mind that this lady's from Mustang. I mean it, Diane. D-A-T or they stay in.
Diane sighs and spins her cigarette holder once, somehow not spraying ash everywhere. Oh, Faisal, you know I can't say no to you.
And then she's the one to nod to the intake officers, as if granting them permission to proceed. Faisal looks frustrated and tense but doesn't say anything, as the officers start pulling papers out as Diane gives him another smile.
Desk appearance it is.
And they get processed right back out again. None of the officers look particularly thrilled about it. Though, to be fair, most of them are too busy ogling in a vaguely resentful sort of way to be paying attention to Ed's group, as the general hum of the bullpen resumes. To be fair, Ed's focused on Diane, too. She even smiles like Mustang, if you ignore all the stuff like shape and race and actual features. That Ed can't explain away with just Mustang being her best customer or whatever. It's too close, too much a mirror, and you don't get that from just pay-to-play appointments. Unless it's like a really regular thing. How regular of a thing? How well does she know Mustang? Is she mirroring him on purpose? Why? Ed's so absorbed he doesn't even realize someone's trying to crowd him until his scalp prickles. Someone broader and taller moving in. A second later, Grabass leans over his shoulder. Close, but not too close, Ed notes with cold satisfaction. Be careful, kid. I can make your life real difficult. It's such a nonsense fucking sentence that for a second, Ed can't even process. Everything just grinds to a halt. Full stop. Make his life difficult? Make his life difficult. Ed just had to call Mustang to let him know that, oops, he might have just fucking put both their boots on a little landmine. Just kickstarted a manhunt and a power struggle they were both really hoping to avoid. And this little two-bit motherfucker is still here, still thinks he can do whatever he wants, still sticking his hands everywhere, still without consequences, still a problem? How? That seems to throw him. What did you say? How are you going to make my life difficult? Ed repeats, turning to face him fully. And he can tell his expression is probably too open, too honest by the way the cop's face flickers with sudden uncertainty. He's 6 foot something, twice Ed's weight, and he's only just now starting to understand it's not going to save him. Come on, tell me. We're leaving, Winry's voice says sharply, right behind Ed, and a hand clamps onto his shoulder. No, this sounds important, Ed says, not letting Wynn move him. If this fucking slime ball wants to be big and scary so bad, Ed will teach him what it means to punch out of your weight class. Sounds like something I need to know. It's important to listen to officers of the law. Grabass is staring at him, and at this point, so is everyone else in arm's reach. But the parts of Ed that can care aren't all that big compared to the rest of him. Awash in rage, so bright it feels like clarity. Think bigger, act later? There is no later. Later is Grabass grabbing someone else, threatening someone else, finding a real kid whose life he really can make miserable. Ed would rather break both his hands in three places and let him learn the hard way that you don't start shit with cute little co-eds, lest one of them turn around and finish it. A lesson without pain is meaningless. You better watch yourself, Grabass says, a second offbeat but still looming. Yeah, this one won't learn without blood. A stream of smoke blows past Ed's ear. Not the time, darling, Diane says, not sounding particularly interested. And once again, Ed hears Mustang. Grabass must hear it too, because his eyes leave Ed for her. The intake officers have slowed or paused, and more than a few others around the bullpen are very much looking like they want to get involved. Make an appointment and you can watch whatever you like, but for now... Here she runs her hand over Ed's hair, playfully tugging his wet ponytail in a way he can tell isn't anything but a threat. We're on a schedule. Let's go. Her hand stays in his hair. Ed turns his head to look back at her, over his shoulder. She meets his gaze evenly, just as ready and willing to yank him down and drag him out by the hair as he is to put Grabass's head through the glass intake partition. Definitely with Mustang. Let's go, Ed echoes. She lets go. Ed turns to her fully, turning his back on Grabass, and a distant part of him appreciates how easy she's made it to keep him tracking the bigger threat. The high recedes. She's not going to do anything to him, not when he's doing what she wants. The outwash of adrenaline leaves him cold, colder still with the prickle of pre-fight awareness, his clothes feeling twice as heavy and wet as before. Landy, Brinley, Aline, and Nerdlet are all back to staring at him, not even trying to be discreet about it. Maybe it's a little early in life for a full stop no on drinking. There's a car outside, a big, black, low-slung thing, and the redhead gets in the driver's seat while Diane takes the front passenger side. The kids shuffle a bit before Winry opens the back door and starts waving them inside, getting in last before Ed and putting herself as a kind of buffer between him and them. The whole interior smells like Diane, perfume rich enough to register through the exhale of her cigarette, and expensively made enough not to saw across the sinuses despite it. Ed inhales deep, not particularly loving the scent, but aware he needs to regulate. It's starting to register that he, well, he wasn't wrong, but in this case, being right meant almost daring a cop to start a fist fight with him inside a police station. "So," Diane says mildly, reclining in her seat in a way that lets her look back at them, eyes half-lidded. The redhead hasn't moved to start the car. "That could have gone worse." "Thank you very much, Miss Diane," Winry tells her, very polite, even as she shoots at a "we are going to talk" look. The rest of the kids all huddled, silent and staring on the other side. "We really appreciate it."
"You're welcome," Diane says, takes another easy drag of her cigarette, her gaze on Ed. "Now Roy owes me a favor."
That sets Ed on his back foot. He called Mustang to warn him, not for bailout. He was going to get them out himself. "I didn't ask him for this." Diane tilts her head just so at him, her cold eyes luminous even in the dim light of the street lamps.
"Would you like to own me instead?"
Ed slowly sets his jaw. His pride says yes. Owing the bastard is one thing. Owing other people through Mustang, though, Ed's not anyone's handout case. And whatever debts he incurs, he'll pay for. His problem, his payment. It's what being a man means. But Diane didn't say that like someone just trying to make a point. If he tells her, "Yes, this one's on me," she'll take it. And he has no idea who this lady even is, while she very clearly knows him. Better to deal with the devil you know. "No," he says, trying not to talk through his teeth. "I'll stick to Roy." That makes her smile, brilliantly white teeth gleaming.
"Smart puppy,"
she says, too approving to be anything but mocking.
"Though he did say you were."
She says it like she definitely didn't believe it, and still doesn't, twisting back around and casually checking her lip color in the rearview mirror.
"I can drop you off on the Victory Hill station. It's on the way. Trolleys will be running in half an hour." "Oh, and he said don't touch the paperwork. He'll let you know if he needs anything."
Fucking great. Ed knew he'd be relying on Mustang anyway in order to fully sort out his identity bullshit. Part of why he'd avoided addressing it so far. If he forces himself to be honest. So it's not too much of a stretch for Mustang to just take over and do it all himself. Especially since he's got Hughes at his disposal, and Ed doesn't. But there's a difference between agreeing to allocate tasks based on resources and being told to sit down and keep his nose out of it. Worse still, to deserve it. One unexpected police run-in, 1 second of reflex taking over, one stupid fucking party drink. Just like that, Ed's in debt up to his collarbones. Six people out of lockup in the middle of the night, a paper maze race for Mustang to run if he doesn't want both of them yanked back into a political knife fight neither of them have time for. And because Ed's just that smart, that quick, that talented, whenever he screws it big, he's never alone. Winry's right here with red marks on her wrists from the cuffs, Landy with her half-dried tears, Aline white-faced and Brinley and some kid whose name Ed doesn't even fucking know, all crammed back in here with him. All because he let one stupid little cop stop spin out of control. And he would have taken it further. He doesn't know who the fuck Diane is, but if Mustang had sent someone else, Ed wouldn't have turned his back on Grabass until the man was out cold on the ground. He hadn't cared that the room was teeming with other officers, that he would have gotten guns drawn on him, drawn on Winry, that it wouldn't have fixed a goddamn thing. He's got a problem. The end.
Till I walk in.
Don't stop, make it pop. DJ gonna speak us up tonight. I'ma fight till we see the sunlight. Tick tock on the clock, but the party don't stop. No. Don't stop, make it pop. DJ gonna speak us up tonight. I'ma fight till we see the sunlight. Tick tock on the clock, but the party don't.
The music used in this podfic is TikTok by Kesha. Author's notes. Ed discovering he's monogamous. God fucking damn it! Edward Elric, congenitally a pillow princess, even when he's actively topping. Roy hangs up. He considers peeling his eyes open. He decides against this. He picks up the phone again. He dials. Back room, back office. Who you talking to?
Hey, Becca. Roy says, not opening his eyes. It's me. Can you get me Di?
Ooh, boy. Becca says and gets him Di.
Hey, Di. You Di.
Diane says boredly, which is how she's been answering the phone since she was 16.
Why are you awake? Do we need to leave the country again? Remember how in seventh year you stole my school uniform and gave it to your boyfriend to cut up? Oh my God, seriously? So you could do that creepy cabaret and it ruined my uniform? That was like 20 years ago. And the National Assembly visit was the next day and I almost got expelled for it.
Di makes a violently disgusted noise, probably stubbing out a cigarette.
Oh, for fuck's sake, just tell me what you want. Spring some kids from West Central lockup.
Kids?
Well, one, but the others will be useful later. And who the fuck is this one, exactly?
Di says suspiciously, which means she's gonna do it.
Roy sighs. A national treasure, he says, giving her the details, then rolls over and goes back to sleep.
If you enjoyed this podfic, you can leave feedback, both for myself and for the author. You can find this podfic at archiveofourown.org/users/opalsong. And from there, you can find a link to the podfic, and from the podfic post, you can find a link to the text post. Thanks for listening!